Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Hello and welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Adrian Main, joined by Justin Robert Young.
Hi, it's Christmas Eve, friends. Thank you for joining us here on such a joyous occasion.
Absolutely. I mean, for us at least. I mean, I'm sure there's some despair happening elsewhere in the world, but yeah, we're here.
Yeah. Well, you know, we're here for everybody. While Bryce and Brian are, you know, spending time with their families and making lifelong connections and memories that nobody will ever forget, we know what's really important. And that is the weird news that you guys crave. You know, look, Santa can't deliver it. It's up to us.
Yeah. Well, shunt yourselves off away, in my case, from my family and come do this. You know, I'm glad we're doing this. I missed last week because I was traveling. And this week, some kind of cool, very cool, surprising news. And this is going to be a Merry SpaceX Mess episode. We've talked about how Elon Musk and SpaceX has been working towards developing the next generation rocket, which has gone through several different names, the ITS, the Mars Colonial Transporter, MCT, BFR for Big Falcon Rocket, and then the latest name, we're told, and probably the final name, is Starship for the upper stage, and then Super Heavy for the booster. Now, we knew that they were starting construction because they've told us this. They've been working on the engines. What makes this rocket special is that it's taking everything they've learned about rocketry so far and where they want to put the technology next and putting it all into a fully reusable stack that can do missions into low Earth orbit and can also send people to Mars. And the rocket also is different than ones before. Like the Falcon 9 rockets use RP-1, which is, you know, kind of like jet fuel, like kerosene. The new one's going to use methane. It's going to be methane based. So it'll be a cleaner burn, very different than what they've used before. Methane's been used in rockets before, but this is a new thing for SpaceX. Much more powerful engines, incredibly powerful engines. And we knew they were starting construction on part of it. I've actually driven by. They have a facility in San Pedro, California, which is not too far from the SpaceX factory, where they're going to be working on construction of the large rocket. But also, they have in Boca Chica, they have facilities there in McGregor, Texas, where they're working on the rocket. And we just got photos from something that had not been announced. You know, we knew they were working on developing basically a hopper. Like, remember when they tested the Falcon 9? They did the Grasshopper, which was the rocket that would go up and land over the farmland area.
Yeah.
Well, it turns out that, you know, they'd said, yeah, we're going to be building kind of a testing platform like that for the Starship, we'll call it now. And we got the first photos. The first photos leaked of what people were unsure of what it was at first. Some people thought it was a water tower. Some people thought it was just some sort of equipment relating to, I think, a University of Texas project, but Elon Musk has all but confirmed what we're looking at is the first photos for the prototype for testing the engines for doing vertical takeoff and landing.
We are showing it here on screen, but it is, you know, I guess the big cone is kind of the giveaway, but this looks like a gigantic metallic stack that is being built out there in Texas.
Yeah, I'll send you a link to from Elon's official Twitter stream, a photo that he tweeted out of it showing it, which is what's being constructed. And again, this is a prototype. This is not going to go into orbit. This is going to be the thing they use to test to make sure the thing can take off and land. They'll probably iterate over this design, work on adding, you know, maybe change about the landing gear for whatever they need to do. But they need to make sure, you know, the engines, I think, can go up and it can land. The orbital version, the one that will actually go into space and beyond, is going to still be manufactured in San Pedro. What this is, you know, there are two critical elements to this rocket. the two critical elements come down to, and also there's some big revelations came out from how they're making this. But the two main parts of a rocket are your engines, you know, the engines that are going to power it, and then what the material it's made out of. The engines will get you up into space, but the material you make it out of determines how well it can land or come back into the atmosphere or land on Earth or Mars. Because the problem is that when you're coming from Mars or going to Mars, you have tremendous amount of your velocity. You're going, 25,000 miles an hour or so, 30,000 miles per hour. I forget the specific velocity that is. When you hit the atmosphere, you're going so fast, you have to take all that energy and you have to get rid of it. And you do that by breaking in the atmosphere, essentially, which means you're producing a tremendous amount of heat. When spaceships re-enter the Earth's atmosphere and you see that glow, like on the shuttle or space capsules, it's not because the upper atmosphere is like a big plasma furnace. It's because they're going so fast, it's generating this tremendous amount of heat. Now, the problem with that heat is that it melts things. Yeah. Now, we lost one of our space shuttles because on re-entry, one of the tiles was loose and all that heat then melted part of the wing and then just tore apart the shuttle because it was just so much force. So dissipation of heat is a very critical thing, and that was one of the big debates, was what are they going to be making this thing out of?
And so what do we know what it is going to be made out of?
Yes, and so Elon says that what they're doing is, if you look at some of the other photos, it's very, very shiny stainless steel. It's an alloy of it's a variant of stainless steel that's got they say that it's at room temperature, it's not as strong as carbon fiber, but at higher temps and lower temps, it's much stronger than carbon fiber. So originally we thought it was going to make the whole thing out of carbon fiber, and I think that was their plan. But I think meanwhile, they were looking at using different alloys and stuff because carbon fiber has advantages.
So no, this was the big thing that was like the freak out in the subreddit from a few weeks ago where people were now questioning how much was the give back on capacity and lift and everything because it was going to be a heavier material.
Yeah, he said something heavier and then people thought metal, and now apparently he's going to be using stainless steel. It's going to be highly reflective. Whether or not parts of it are still going to have, there's new materials they have that are super heat resistant. Stainless steel is really good at not absorbing heat, at be limiting that. So we'll see what's going to happen. But, what they've talked about before is they're going to do a couple kinds of testing. First, you have this platform here. They're going to put three of their new Raptor engines, which are the methane burning engines. They're going to use that to power because that's how many engines it'll need to land. They're going to have three Raptor engines in this. Take it off, land it, and probably increase the amount of weight that goes on board it. They also mentioned, Elon had mentioned previously that they were going to build kind of a mini version of, they called it the BFR, mini BFR, but now it's Starship, that would go on board a Falcon 9 booster. And that was to test reentry. So that what they want to do is they want to probably build, like a third scale or something like version of it that's got the control surfaces and all of that, and to see how well it can handle reentry. So we're going to see different kinds of testing. So the big revelation here was, one, stainless steel construction. Two, that they already have something that's kind of far along. And I don't remember if you recall this, but we made a prediction a year ago on here that we would be seeing some sort of physical hardware that looked like this thing maybe around November. So we were off. But close. We thought we would see something. Elon would surprise us with something. And this was, more than, I think we just thought a mock-up. And it's way more than a mock-up.
And this is much more than that. So this is the vehicle that would go to Mars, right? Like that is the big idea here, right?
Yeah, I mean, this specific one we're looking at, did you get the image I sent you?
Where did you send it?
Your email. So this is the... this thing that we're seeing constructed here, this will go up, this will go several kilometers up in the air and will land, but and it's actually going to be shorter than the orbital version. But this is the one that we'll test. Like the Grasshopper was used to test the engines for landing the boosters. This is going to use to test the Raptor engines and that hardware for landing.
Sure. Yeah. But ultimately the vehicle that they are building.
This is the Mars rocket.
The Mars rocket. Yeah. All right, here we go. This is what Elon tweeted out. Stainless steel Starship with a knight builder. This is after sundown. with the nose cone and then the big stack there next to it.
Yeah, zoom in to the one of the cherry pickers on the stack if you can.
Okay.
Let me pull up something kind of cool too, which I'll send to you. So, you know, the fun thing is that, you know, Elon, you know, likes to reveal things in small pieces, and then certainly things he can't control, like people can drive by that facility there and take photos, which they've done. And now I'm going to pull up a comparison.
So we are now pulled up to the people in the cherry pickers. Is there like a hint here?
Well, look at the size. Look at the size, the scale of it.
Oh, sure. Of how big.
Yeah. No, I'm going to send you another one, which is a link or a.
So
Reddit
just
forum
for
photo
our
or
for our for our audio listeners, these are looks like you know, industrial cherry pickers that are stretched to their absolute limit to get what looks to be at the very bottom of what will be a massive spaceship.
Yeah, so I've sent you another one where somebody went in and they took all the images we've seen and composited together into like what the full stack will look like. And this isn't the fine. This is just for the Hopper. The full version is going to be even taller than this. But they put the full stack next to a Falcon 9 with the crew capsule, and so you get an idea of just what how big the upper stage is. So you know the upper stage is going to be when finished. I think as tall as the actual first stage booster on a Falcon 9. But way, 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 way bigger, and yeah, we're looking at a classic looking, you know, rocket, you know, a Flash Gordon upright landing on its back with legs, tripod legs coming out of it, and now with it being this shiny stainless steel, so you can see if you scroll to the bottom, you'll see how big this thing is, how big around it is compared to a Falcon 9, and this is just the, you know, this is the upper stage.
So this would be basically, we are, I'll try to zoom in on this for, I don't even know where we're going to have this in video, but for people who are watching live, this is the composite of everything that has been shown so far, with the idea being that what's next to it is the initial mock-up of it?
The one on the right is what they'll be. What they did is there's several, the thing is in several pieces right now. They have the lower section of the Starship, and they have several parts of it, part because it's so massive to work on and they have to still put fuel tanks in and everything else inside of there. And also just the scale, it's so big to try to work on this thing that eventually we're going to see, probably a gantry system or something where they're going to have, like, I imagine to work on this, there's going to be like a scaffolding system and stuff. You remember that was the problem with like both the Saturn V and the space shuttle was that if you go to the largest building in the world by like height and volume or whatever is the vehicle assembly plant in NASA where they would Cape Canaveral or Kennedy Space Center, where you could actually see, you know, these things were tall enough to hold. You look at the space shuttle and the tanks, you go, man, that's massive. I'm like, yeah, there's a building that holds that.
Yeah, right.
and that's what it takes. And cranes that lift all that into position, because you see that on launch pad. It's like, yeah, that had to get there. So the next thing is an image. This is from a Redditor, and I apologize. I don't. Let me see if I can find their name. They show you kind of the scale of this compared to this. This is Miss Tokyo, I think, has provided this. She actually put some composite photos, or I'm assuming it's she. We'll call her she because it's a miss, but you know, we're getting sort of comparisons to understand the scale of, and that's the thing, is that this is a beast.
So this is where the spaceship would meet the booster. Okay, so what is next to it is the booster that would launch it, and then the composite of the spaceship itself, which is effectively either the size to 80% of the booster. It would be 180 feet to 219 feet. So it is almost as big as the booster itself.
Yeah, 387 feet tall.
Total, okay. Yeah.
So yeah, that's incredibly, you know, not quite twice as tall as a Falcon 9, but it's a massive thing. And looking at the scale of this thing, like with the people on the cherry pickers next to it, and understanding that that's not even the full scale version, it's big. And this wasn't the big. This is also what we call the downscaled BFR. The BFR originally was going to be much larger.
Yeah.
And then Elon Musk scaled it back because of funding issues and realized that if they made a downscaled version of it, it could be useful for doing a lot of Earth, you know, low Earth orbit. And so it kind of fund itself from, you know, work.
Instead of just building a thing only for that long distance travel, this could actually pay for itself by running around the Earth a couple times.
Yeah, exactly. Launching satellites, taking over what the Falcon 9 does.
Yeah. Holy moly, man. That is crazy. So, I mean, you know, do you have any predictions for next year on what we will see?
Elon had said that he wants to start testing. They're like, you see a crew working there at night, and the goal is he wants to start doing hop testing on this thing March or April.
So we will start to see those famous drone footage, Texas launch, like those up and down videos sometime in the spring.
Yeah, I mean, we could be 90 days away or a little more. I mean, Elon Musk, you know, he'll be the first one to tell you about his timelines. But we were expecting to see hop tests maybe like later this year, like much later. But if he's saying this, you know, March or April, then we'll probably maybe first half of the year. They've gotten better at their estimates for time frames. So we'll see. And that's going to be an interesting thing because we're going to see something that's going to look a lot like the final product out there taking off and landing. That's, you know, it's got the construction on this is the surface of this is this stainless steel, but it's not you'll see some other pictures of this where it's very shiny, but it looks kind of like faceted. And that has to do with more the fact that this is not the one that has to do reentry. So the final version, they actually have their own foundry where they're going to be, you know, they're about ready to have the foundry go online, and they're going to be producing their own, you know, stainless steel and using materials that are made custom for them. So the final one's going to look a lot more fit and smoother than this version. This is basically to test, do these engines work? Can we take off? Does our fuel supply system work? Can we get what we need out of that system? And then we'll test the next stages of it.
Well, very, 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 very exciting stuff. I mean, anytime that you can get a physical glimpse of the future, I think that's kind of been the exciting part about SpaceX in comparison to how we've thought about space exploration in the past, is that in the past we've seen a lot of drawings, right? You know, and then sometimes the reality is something less than it is. The rapid iteration has just, I think, spoiled us, considering how fast it's gone from an announcement to a prototype, to hop tests, to actually being in use, which is rad. But I'll tell you what, you guys can support us doing this kind of chatter by going to patreon.com/weirdthings. Again, patreon.com/weirdthings is where you need to go to make sure that you support this very show. A show that will come to you on Christmas Eve. Yes. I don't know over there. Patreon.com.
Who does that? Who does it? I mean, other than people who aren't, you know, religious, you know, or follow the Christian faith.
Exactly.
Other than that.
You know, exactly. As I said in the newsletter, the freepoliticalnewsletter.com this morning, it is the Christmas holiday, or as our Jewish friends call it, that weird Monday and Tuesday where things are closed and have weird hours. So, all right. Andrew.
Yes.
What else is going on in the world of weird?
Well, we had another cool space-related announcement, which was NASA has put out a photo. This was captured by actually the European Space Agency. Pardon me. This is the European Space Agency from their high-resolution stereo camera. And what they've done is shown us a photo of Korolev Crater, which is a crater on Mars, which is actually filled with water ice. And it's named for Sergei Korolev, who was the Russian genius behind much of their success in their space program. You know, we had Wernher von Braun and had others working, but, you know, Korolev was a guy that, you know, made some amazing innovations, and that we didn't even know who he was because he was like a state secret. But now there's a big crater name for him. If you take a look at this thing, it's amazing. It's this couple miles deep ice, and it's 51 miles across. You know, the deepest point, it's about 1 mile deep. So if you can find a Korolev crater, it's kind of a really cool image to look at and think of, like, you know, that's kind of what, you know, we're going to go see. So again, this was by the ESA. Had done this with one of their satellites orbiting Mars, taking a series of photographs, and over time was able to put this thing together. Have you found it?
Yes. So yeah, this is...
There we go.
There we go. Wow. Mars orbiter sends a picture-perfect postcard back to Earth just in time for the holiday. The Korolev crater formed sometimes in Mars's turbulent past, writes The Verge, when another object slammed into the northern lowlands of the planet, leaving a scar 50 miles wide and more than a mile deep where ice water slowly accumulated. Wow, that is wild. That looks amazing.
Yeah. That's one of the reasons that Mars is exciting, is that we see these photos. The photos we generally get from the surface of Mars are from the safest places to land probes, which tend to be, I wouldn't say boring, because there's a lot of, they're fascinating places, but geographically, they're very flat. We put them in planes. We tend to put them in places where we know the probes aren't going to have too much trouble landing. But Mars geography is way more than this wide open flat desert. Mars geography in certain places is way more variation, actually, than Earth has, actually. If you look at the size of Olympus Mons, which is, you know, the largest above-ground volcano in the solar system, this thing's huge, dwarfs anything on Earth. And then if you go into the rift valleys, you have, you know, the trench valleys there are huge, colossal, that just stretch on for, you know, 1,000 miles. It's just insane how big these things are, that you could fit, you know, several Grand Canyons inside of these and have room for everything else. And then you have other features. There's features at the southern pole that they call them like the spiders, because what they are is that it's probably like CO2 outgassing during times of the year, and it leaves these weird sort of spider formations. Not to mention under Mars, where I think is going to be the most exciting place to explore, is there are cavern systems that go on for probably hundreds of miles or thousands of miles that are lava tubes. Remember, a lot of what forms caverns on Earth has to do with limestone rock and erosion. As far as we know, Mars never got limestone, because limestone was produced by life forms that broke down, little shells of those organisms. So we don't have anything, as far as we know, about limestone on Mars, but we have volcanic tunnels, the tubes that we've seen from the surface occasionally when they've collapsed in there, that are massive. And this is a thing I keep bringing up. We think there could be caverns on the moon that you could put Philadelphia in size of. And it's possible Mars has similar things, massive, very large caverns, 1/3 gravity, which means things can form larger. The amount of volcanic activity that it had early on, and then you lacked the same amount of erosion we had for things to wear away. So under Mars is going to be exciting, but here you have this, you know, this ice cap that's this 50 mile across lake of frozen ice.
That's insane. I mean, because it was not long ago where we were talking about the idea of water or ice on Mars in general, mm-hmm. right? Like, I mean, like, talk about a rapidly evolving understanding of such a far flung place. Like when that was like, oh, I think we've possibly found proof of water on Mars, and now we're looking at, you know, a picture worth 1,000 words, a gigantic ice lake. That's pretty rad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's. You know, the book of The Martian is a great book. And if you ever read The Martian, read The Martian. But the science of The Martian was already out of date probably by the time the book came out. And we knew about the abundance of water and all that. And that's one of the things in the book, like, you know, they're using a form of rocket fuel we're probably never going to use on Mars, and trying to get oxygen and hydrogen out of it so they can make water. Or they're trying to get hydrogen out of the rocket fuel or whatever they were trying to do so they could produce water with it. It's not likely what you'll have to do. If you're going to want to get water on Mars, you're just going to go outside and you're going to go dig into some of the ground or the permafrost or whatever you call it there, and just melt it out.
Melt it.
You know, there's so much water there, and you know, you know, but it's, again, it's a highly entertaining book. I don't, but don't.
Well, and
don't
also it's
for
like,
go for the spirit of exploration. Not the
well,
science.
Well, and also it's like, hey, look, that was just an unfortunate, we learned a lot about Mars really fast around the time that the book became really popular.
Okay.
unless you want to turn this into a diss track for The Martian.
I love the movie. The movie's great. But I want to say that's the thing. The mindset we have to work people around is thinking this is what Mars is. It's like, no. Like, you don't have windstorms like this. There's a lot of water. Get that picture of Mars out of your head, because Mars is way more exciting and possibly habitable than we realized, you know. And so I just want to put the book in context. Again, I think it's got so many people excited about Mars and space, and it's great, but it's like put that science out of your head and realize that Mars is very different.
Yes.
But exciting. So love the book. With that book, you get books every now and then come out that get people so excited for something, and it's we need more of that. You know, I love the fact that you had in Hollywood made into a great movie that, to, you know, look at every dumb Mars movie we had where it's, we got to have aliens on Mars, we got to have this, we got a great survival story, you know, about being clever and doing clever things and not finding the cryptogram and finding the Martian gods, you know. It'll always have a soft spot in my heart because of that. Hey, Justin.
Yes.
We're a little more on a space kick here.
Mm-hmm.
You want to take a trip?
I would love to. I would love to take a trip.
Do you want to go to far out?
Yeah, Daddy-O. Let's go far out.
Far out, which I believe its provisional name is 2018 VG18, is the most distant known object in the solar system. Okay. And this is what we call them extreme trans-Neptunian objects, which are things that go out beyond the orbit of Neptune. Remember, Neptune has this weird orbit with like Pluto where they kind of cross at a certain point. But anyhow, far out is way the heck out there. It's 120 AU. So you take the distance between the Earth and the Sun and times that by 120 times. And then you find far out. Now, far out's not the planet X we've been looking for. Far out is just another object that – let me see how big far out is. It takes 1 year, one Earth year on us to orbit the Sun, of course, why it's a year. It takes 1,000 Earth years for it to make one orbit, okay? So Pluto's 34 AUs. This is four times the distance Pluto is from the Sun. That's how far out is. As far as our guess, like, we can only look at, like, we get a little glimmer and we look at how much light's reflected off of it. And we're like, you know, we think maybe it's about 300 miles, 370 miles across, which is not insignificant. I mean, that's, you could build on that. You could land on that. You know, you run and you kick off and you could, you know, probably fly away from there. But it's what we call planets now. You know, we have this sort of long definition, but we call it a dwarf planet. So it's dwarf planet.
Sure.
So, but Planet X, what we're looking for, is still not Planet X, but this is sort of an exciting revelation. We talk about this here is that there's a lot more far outs out there. There's a lot more objects out there like that. And there's possibly, very, very likely, something way more massive than Earth way out there in the outer reaches of our solar system, which also means we could have Earth-sized objects out there or Mars-sized objects out there too, which is... if you think about like what space exploration means, it's not like we just go to Mars. We're like, hey, we're on Mars. Great.
Yeah.
Now everything's done. We keep going further and further out. You can go to Titan, the one around Saturn, not the one that Thanos is from. You go to Titan and Europa around Jupiter. You've got these other moons, which are massive and fascinating. And then we can keep going further out to places like far out and other objects and stuff. And if you want to have a rapidly expanding solar economy, then kind of awesome.
So let's like rough guess time frame on something like that. Like, let's assume like what is a realistic idea for time frame for Mars? Like where we would put people on Mars and then let's expand that out to how fast we could use it as a stepping stone to get even further out?
So for Mars, you know, with Mars, we've got a window. You know, you have that window every like 26 months or something where that's the time to launch, because that's when Earth and Mars come closest because of our orbits. You know, Earth orbits like this. Mars is takes twice as long to go around the sun, but there's a point at which you take off and you need the least amount of fuel to get there. Now, the orbital windows are, the next one is like 2020, I think 2022 is when that opens, and it stretches over like, you know, to 2023, I think. But anyhow, that's when SpaceX says that they want to launch unmanned versions of the Starship. They want to send like two unmanned versions of the Starship with equipment and tech to land on Mars, to go try to drill for water and all that. They hope to make 2022. That's their goal, whether or not they hit it. The next window is 2024. And so 2024, 2026. I'm optimistic by 2024, you know, we'll have sent the first SpaceX craft, you know, the first ones capable of carrying people, but will be unmanned. I'm, you know, I think that in the next decade, we're going to put people on Mars.
Okay. You know, so people on Mars, people on Mars in the 2020s, the roaring 20s. And so then let's say 20 years after that, that we could look at it as a launching point to go even further.
Well, if you want to go further, one, I don't know that it, I think that we have the potential for an amazing age of space exploration. And, you know, right now people are, you know, talking about the stock market, you know, the stock market had this big, huge correction, and it's, you know, in the short term, it's terrifying. In the long term, it's another one of those little crevices in the graph. And you look at the overall trend of the graph and you go, okay, if I don't panic, you know, I think I'll be fine. Space exploration, in my opinion, is going to be a big technology driver and could be a big driver for the rest of the 21st century because of one of the things we find out with space exploration is when you're in weightlessness, you can make materials that we could not make on Earth. You can make semiconductors. You can create new classes of chemistry and things like that that were not possible. And that's the biggest driving force of our economy now is information technology, is computing technology. And it's not trying to find large amounts of raw resources. You don't want to go to Mars. It's, if we found all the gold, you know, we wanted on Mars, wouldn't make a difference.
It doesn't really make a lot of sense to haul it all back. Like, this is not just like a mining colony.
No, you have to think about it like we found a lot of cures and things like that in rainforests. You know, we look to the ocean and we find a lot of biotech, and we've had thousands of years on Earth of playing around with materials and discovering the properties of, you know, of things like, you know, iron and nickel and tin and these materials or crystals. And, you know, we use lasers. That laser technology was driven by playing around with rubies and other materials and crystalline things. When you're in space, you have entirely new categories of things you can make in zero gravity, because in zero gravity, crystals can be much larger, much more pure, because they're not being squished by the ablative properties of being in gravity. We've talked about this before. Antibiotics that work perfectly well on Earth do not work. Some of them don't work as well or don't work at all in space, and we don't know why.
Huh.
We don't have an explanation on the books that we've accepted as for why these things, because we think we know how they work, but you put in microgravity and they don't work, which means that there might be things that do work in microgravity. And if we understood why those things didn't work, it could give us an insight into biotechnology.
Yeah.
You know, I've got a list of these things that, like, once you do here, you get to take all the innovations you created on Earth, and now you get to figure out next level versions of this because of what comes from doing experimentation. You go to Mars and you have geochemistry that was formed with one third Earth's gravity with different material compositions than we have on Earth. You're going to find things that are very similar, you know, basic elemental, you know, gold, uranium, they're going to be the same. But the way certain things form, crystals, all sorts of other geodes and stuff, we find, you know, some of the stuff in our semiconductor industry are things that we found, like cave crystals, things like this, and you don't need a lot of them, or they have very interesting properties. So there's going, and then once you start growing things in space, once you start making, you know, bacteria that's been made in weightless environments, it's going to have a very different DNA structure than bacteria on Earth. All these things, what I'm saying is that, like, I think there's going to be a point at which there's usually the fake bubble, which I think we'll get once we go to Mars and like, hey, let's do Martian exploration. And then it's the returns are going to be longer. It's like the internet. You know, we had the crash in 2001, 2002 around that period. And then people are like, well, we've seen it. We're done. And then that's when Google IPO'd and the companies that now dominate the internet actually started there or after.
Yeah.
Space be the same way. So with that money going into space exploration, I guess what I'm saying is that with money going into once you can realize real returns, there's going to be the silly ones like, I have beer made in space. But once like, oh, no, this new antibiotic, you know, we can make, you know, 5 kilograms of it on a satellite, bring it back to Earth, and it's worth $1 billion, something like that. That's a game changer. Then
So there's more money, right? Like, so let's understand that if we're going to set up any timeline, that we have to understand that it will pair with where the money is at for more exploration. Okay. So if it's 2024, let's that we have a manned or no, have any kind of touchdown on Mars, right? With on SpaceX projection, if we're going to then from there, like, chart out people on Mars, a colony on Mars, the business of Mars, that it will take a little sine graph of that that economic boom and bust before we say, okay, this is a thriving part of an interstellar or a multi-planet economy, and now we can think about adding to that chain because we've understood how this makes money.
So what we'll have is, I think we're going to get an increasing wave of exploration with rockets like the Starship, and then what Blue Origin's working on with the new Armstrong eventually in that. We're going to get that, and you're going to get, as the cost is reduced a lot, you're going to look at, like, the Space National Geographic Society looking to send human missions and stuff to other places, NASA expanding. We're going to get a lot of that exploration. We're going to get this. The next big change is going to be when we radically change how we send rockets and how we propel them. Not getting off Earth, but actually around the solar system. And this is where we've talked about before. We actually had on as a guest Jonathan Madajan, who works at Dr. Phil Lubin's lab at UC Santa Barbara. And that's where they're working on laser propulsion. And laser propulsion is basically, you have a highly reflective disc, you shine a laser at it, and the photonic kick pushes this. And the bigger, the more powerful the laser is, the faster it goes. Right now, we have the tech to build it, but the cost is ridiculously high. 10 to 15 to 20 years from now, to talk about building super powerful laser systems in orbit around Earth and other places to send things ridiculously fast to the outer reaches of the solar system or even beyond become possible. And I think that'll be when you start talking about, you know, back to the question about far out, you know, about a place like that. That's when it becomes really feasible. That's when you could send something to there in a couple weeks. And it would go right down past it until you have a system to kick it from the other direction. So,
yeah.
Anyhow.
So 20 years from when we put a man on Mars, when we have a colony, let's start it at, there is a functioning colony on Mars. How many years before we then use Mars as a stepping stone to go further out? Or do we not use Mars as a stepping stone? I guess what you're saying is that we'll figure out a way to just get stuff from Earth out.
Well, the advantage of using Mars is the problem of using Mars as stepping stones. What do we mean by stepping stone? I think we're going to be going towards exploring these places well before there's a manufacturing base on Mars.
Yes.
You know, we can't make an iPhone in the United States. We cannot make an iPhone in the United States. If you said, I want to start producing iPhones in the United States next year, making all the things here locally, you could not do it next year. 4 to 5 years from now, maybe, because the factories, the facilities, the infrastructure, the mines, all these things are spread out around the world. And when you talk about using Mars to, you know, to try to explore the rest of the solar system, it could be a stopping point. You know, it could be a point where you send hardware to it and we fill it up with methane there and send it off. But, you know, to be building stuff on there, and you know, I get this a lot, people like, oh, we should be building stuff on the moon. And I'm like, eventually. But, you know, people forget how hard it is to build stuff without a manufacturing base.
Yeah.
So I think it's concurrent. I think that while we're exploring Mars, we'll be exploring other places. That's the beautiful thing. It's not like we do this, then we can do this.
Yeah.
Let's go. You know, we're going to be sending a starship around the moon while we're getting ready to send people to Mars.
I don't think that people think of it as a prerequisite necessarily, or I don't think of it as a prerequisite, but I do think that there's probably going to just be an order of operations in terms of like, okay, well, we do this thing. And like you said, I think that it's very wise to look at any kind of expectation and timeline with, okay, well, where's the money? Like, why, where is this going to pay off for people? Because ultimately, it's, you know, while I think even something like totally altruistic, governmental scientific exploration will be greatly benefited by all these products being cheaper and have already been,
Government projects tend not to last longer than administrations. And that's the problem that NASA's been dealing with for years, is that, you know, in order for NASA to get something funded, certain number of senators have to be very happy because there's projects going on in their state. You get a new president in place who's not too excited about space, which we've had happen. And often it's not the person you expect it to be. And then you get, you know, you don't get to do the things you wanted to. You want to go where the money is. And I think the problem is that space tourism is cool. Like, space tourism is cool. It's low hanging fruit. It'll be a neat thing, but it's not the way to make a long standing sustainable industry. If your goal was, I want to manufacture computers and I'm only going to manufacture 20 computers, 100 computers a year, because I think that's the total size of the market, you're going to be like the computing industry was for 30 years.
Yeah.
You know, you have to sort of say, no, what's the real value here? You know, the real value is everybody having one on their desktop. The real value is saying, what makes space cool besides, oh, this is really cool. It's the physics, it's the chemistry, it's all of that. And once that happens, I was excited because there was the mission. Remember a couple weeks ago, SpaceX launched Space Systems or Rocket Systems. It was the company that had like 34 separate smaller satellites on board. And they did. They ejected all of them, and it was about 34 different institutions were able to come together and put payloads on there. When you can start sending up the Starship up and say, we're going to spend a month in orbit doing really crazy, cool experiments, and Nike can rent space, Estee Lauder can rent space, everybody who, you know, can, you know, sign a check, you know, can start doing research and stuff. That's going to be exciting. And I think that's the future. Industrial parks, not hotels.
Not hotels. Yeah.
Yeah.
You want to get into picks?
Let's do picks.
I got a pick.
All right.
Folks, I'm ringing your doorbell, and I'm here to spread the good news about Aquaman. I loved Aquaman.
The James Cameron Aquaman?
The highest grossing movie of all time by James Cameron. Vinny Chase, right? That was the Entourage character.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
This starring Jason Momoa, directed by James Wan, has Elon Musk's ex-girlfriend Amber Heard. When the positive reviews first started coming out, I saw the trailer and it looked kind of big and dumb and fun. I was like, oh, okay, well, this seems like it could be something that I would enjoy. What I was not expecting was the fact that it is like very, very, very ambitious in its world building. I've seen some kind of criticism for it, that it is not the character study that, let's say a Marvel movie is. Ultimately, by the end of a Marvel movie, I think no matter how ridiculous your characters are, like, you care about Michael Peña's character in Ant-Man, right? Like, you want him to succeed and do well, and whenever, like, he has a little subplot, you care about whether or not he's going to file papers on time because you care about him. I will say that Aquaman is not necessarily that. Like, there is not deep, rich character work that you care about. A lot of the characters are kind of just moved along the board. However, it is, you know, oddly enough, I keep coming back to kind of Lord of the Rings as sort of an explainer for this. It's like, in the same way that Lord of the Rings, I don't know if I really knew the most about, the hobbits as they made their way across. I knew that they cared about their mission. I knew that they cared about each other. But I don't exactly know if you were going to drop them into some other story, exactly how they would react or something like that. I didn't know the true heart of the tree Ents. However, I enjoyed the fact that this was a big epic adventure that continued to bring us to new interesting lands and had amazing creature design and fun powers. There is just there's something really, really, really fun about that world. That's the thing. Somebody said, is it big, dumb fun? Yes, in moments. This is a movie that unironically brings us into our second act adventure with a pit bull cover of Toto's Africa. So that is an undeniable element of that DNA. However, by the time that you're at your fourth Atlantean kingdom, Atlantis is its own kingdom. I don't know. Kingdom of the ocean realm that you are now exploring this mythology. I don't think you can call it dumb because they did a really fun, credible job of creating very unique, different lands. You know the difference between the fishermen folk and the crab folk and the barbarian elements of the ocean. Like, it's smart in that, and it's really, really, really creative, and I would encourage everybody to go see it because I think it's a different flavor of comic book movie that is distinct and different from everything that Marvel's done, and you know, into the Spider-Verse, is fantastic. I don't know if we talked about that on the show yet, but look, those are two great movies, and they're great for very, very, very different reasons. And here is where I would illustrate the difference. In Aquaman, the first time that you see Aquaman do Aquaman things, he, in a very straight-ahead 80s kind of moment, shirtless, ripped, tatted Jason Momoa, walks through a burst water main in a very kind of like, you know, masculine 80s Schwarzenegger Stallone kind of way, unironically. There's no wink at the camera. There's no joke to deflate the tension. It was just a straight ahead moment that had a woman in my theater audibly yelp. Like that is how masculine the moment is and unironic in it. That's not what Into the Spider-Verse is. And to its credit, it's a Phil Lord and Chris Miller movie. Every moment that you're going to have this thing, and not to say that they can't build the character moments, but it's meta, it's winky, it's funny. Like, that's why the kind of thing that they do really well, it's the kind of thing that Marvel does really well. But I enjoy the fact that we can have both. And I think for the first time, I looked at a DC movie that wasn't Christopher Nolan, who just does Christopher Nolan things, and said, like, oh, cool. This is what DC movies are. DC movies are a little bit more earnest and straight ahead. Not to say that they're not funny, that they don't have their moments where they make jokes, but that's a different kind of way to go about it. And I thought that was really, 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 really cool.
I look forward to seeing it. I think that the most loved ones now have been Patty Jenkins' Wonder Woman, and this has gotten, you know, a really good response. And I'm excited to see that DC kind of got past what it thought it needed to be and the defensiveness over, like, oh yeah, we're dark and gloomy compared to Marvel. Oh wait, people don't dark and gloomy. You're like, yeah, that's why Dark Knight made no money. That's why, yeah, Dark Knight was like the biggest box. I hated that argument. It was like, no, Dark Knight was an amazing movie. It was the dark and gloomiest you can imagine, you know, for, you know, I mean, you can imagine worse, but I mean, it's a super gloomy movie and it, yeah, made all the money. It's a great movie. The other DC movies were literally dark, gloomy, and not that entertaining to me. And so now with Wonder Woman, which is a delightful film, and I'm excited to go see Aquaman. I like the idea that they found this sort of over-the-top sort of nature. Where do they go? Very cool.
It's a movie where an octopus plays the drums. I'm just going to let you know that an octopus plays the drums, and it's rad.
Nice. Well, that was sort of the weird thing, too, was that when we first heard that we were going to get a new Superman movie after The Dark Knight, there was like, is it going to be in the same universe? Because Nolan worked really hard in the Batman movies not to be – to even kind of get rid of magic. You know, Ra's al Ghul and these other things, it was more metaphorical – that, you know, he wanted to make it sort of very realistic, gritty, you know, kind of things, and sort of have ecological explanations for sort of everything. And then like, well, how are you going to do, you know, Man of Steel, you know, Superman story? And is he going to, you know, was DC going to try to scale it back, make it a different origin that was more sciencey, whatever? And no, we got, you know, kind of, you know, crazy Krypton, all that sort of stuff. And then it kind of, now we're at like an octopus playing the drums. Sounds great.
Yeah.
I'm all for it.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And it's, again, it's a moment, you know, Ruru2 in the chat says Ant-Man had a giant ant playing the drums. Yes.
True.
And therein, you will understand the difference between these two universes, because the ant playing the drums in Ant-Man logically made sense to the plot. There was a reason why he was doing it. It wasn't just a gag, but it's played for laughs. It's a cutaway, yeah. And you see an ant playing the drums, and it's very funny. This is where I don't want to spoil anything, but where the octopus plays the drums, it is a reverential moment where important things are happening. that's the difference. But yeah, so go check it out. I really dug it. A lot of really just fun things in the theater right now, which is great for the Christmas time when people have some time on their hands.
I have three picks.
Pick them.
One, yes, Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse. Go see this movie. I'm sure it'll keep making money over Christmas, but it's not doing anywhere well as this movie deserves to do, I think. Spider-Man, I've seen the movie twice. I love Spider-Man and the Spider-Verse. It was a movie that I was prejudiced against because I'm not big into like the animated stuff. You know, I thought the Marvel animation stuff had not been good. But this was a delight, a really, really strong movie, extremely well done. Everybody knows he's that loves the movie. If you're a Transformers fan, I saw Bumblebee.
Uh-huh.
Bumblebee is delightful. Bumblebee is a kid's film, and you're going to have, you know, why did this happen? It was just quicker to have it happen that way. But Bumblebee is a very, it's a story you're familiar with, you know, in the sense of a, you know, lost person get found by a, you know, youthful person and helps them sort of connect and then have to fight the bad guys. But we get this set in the Transformers universe, directed by Travis Knight, who directed, you know, some previous, stop motion films. This is his first live action film. Hard to call Transformers completely live action, though.
Yeah.
Also, Travis Knight's father is the founder of Nike.
Phil Knight, right?
Yeah. Yep. But Travis is very, very talented. So did a very, very good job. There was this reboot that we were told was supposed to be happening in the Transformers universe, which they had a whole writer's room and they brought in a bunch of people to help like write new stories. And that gave us Transformers The Last Knight. As far as I could tell, this has nothing to do with any. This is a prequel. It takes place in like 1987, so it's consistent with the Transform movies overall. But the one it's least connected to, I can tell, is like Last Knight, because in like Last Knight, they're like, they give you this entire history about Bumblebee, and Anthony Hopkins explaining this in rapid fire. Not in here.
Yeah.
And very, very, that movie, that writer's room project, or, you know, Last Knight seems to have been, yeah, we just sort of pushed that off the stage.
Yeah.
Bumblebee's fun. Opens up on Cybertron, you know, get a big battle there. Kind of cool. And the design of the Transformers is a little bit more retro-y to kind of the toys. So
yeah, that seems to have been the thing that people that I've seen have really kind of responded to is there specifically like right up front, there is like a fan service to old fans of the you know, the toys and the cartoon and stuff like that, where it seems like it just gives all those element like just a big warm blanket up front, like, oh no, trust us, this is going to be the movie that you kind of wanted the other ones to be from the start.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the Michael Bay ones serve their purpose. They're amazing, you know. But it's hard to go, where do you go with the story where it's like, you know, the Decepticons are going to destroy Earth. The Decepticons are going to destroy Earth. But now we have the moon and this and that. My last pick.
Yeah.
I don't know if you saw this. Ballad of Buster Scruggs on Netflix.
Oh, I loved Ballad of Buster Scruggs. Man, what a world that we get to have that on Netflix and just kind of enjoy it the way that it was. But so fun. So fun. Like, obviously, the Coen brothers have a deep love for not only the Western genre in general, but also Western movies. And it was so fun to be able to just see their take on so many different versions of it, from the singing cowboy to the wagon train to the kind of like gothic metaphor of the desolate West. Like it was just so good. And then also just that first the first one with Buster Scruggs is just one of the most delightful things that I think I saw all year.
It was absolutely, and because I didn't know what, I mean, I heard maybe it's anthology, whatever. And so you watch that and then you're like, oh, this is a cool, you know, anthology sort of series. Anthology, you know, more, you know, comprised of smaller films, however we want to describe that. The big surprise for me was the performance in the one called The Meal Ticket, played by Dudley from Harry Potter.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
That's all I want to say about that. It was, I thought, you know, I didn't realize it was him. Like, I didn't know. And then I'm like, oh my God, that's Dudley. So all of it was great. Question, does Bumblebee talk in Transformers? In the beginning, he does.
Well, there we go.
So anyhow, but yeah, Buster Scruggs.
It's the way to go. All right, man. Do you have any Christmas wishes to the Weird Things faithful?
Don't start any fires.
Well, there we go. A practical warning from a practical man. All right. Is that about it for this episode?
I think so. Thanks to everybody for joining us. It's been weird.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.